Welcome, mountain bikers. Thanks for tuning in to Vital MTB's The Inside Line podcast. This is Brandon Terman. So I recently had the pleasure of catching up with a longtime friend of mine, Joey Schuessler. In recent years, Joey has played a big role as a writer, director, filmer, and photographer in some truly incredible films and features that you've no doubt laid your eyes on at some point. We recorded this in Snowmass, Colorado at the 17th annual Yeti Tribe Gathering, which is a multi-day get-together of Yeti freaks, owners, fans, in a cool location, just riding bikes and having a good time. Snowmass is a place where Joey has a lot of history as a race winner, so it was only fitting that we touch on his journey from local Grom and U.S. hopeful to World Cup racing, World Champs, Enduro racing, and how they've helped fuel the adventures that he's up to today. Hope you guys enjoy the show.
This Vital MTB Inside Line podcast is brought to you by Jensen USA. Shop for great deals and get professional advice on your favorite mountain bikes, components, and riding gear. Over 2 million happy cyclists served since 1994. Visit JensenUSA.com/TheInsideLinePodcast and use code INSIDELINE for 10% off qualifying items. Maxxis Tires. Where the rubber meets the dirt, Maxxis makes no compromise tires for any rider, any trail, any time.
What's up, listeners? You're listening to Vital MTB's The Inside Line podcast. Today we've got a special guest, Joey Schuessler. Joey's a guy I grew up racing with downhill in Colorado. He was one of the top juniors in the USA. He represented the US at several world champs more than once and went on to compete at the World Cup level. Today, he's an award-winning storyteller who's worked with Yeti Cycles and other brands, captures crazy adventures all over the globe. Some really cool stuff, and truly inspires hundreds of thousands of people, hopefully to do the same, get out there and have some fun in the mountains. Joey was always known for having loose wheels back in the day, never getting out of his kit, and I've always described you as a person who has a permanent goggle tan, like year round. You know the raccoon thing?
Oh yeah.
So let's chat about your life just spent adventuring, man.
Yeah, for sure. Let's do it.
Cool. So how'd you get rolling in mountain bikes way back when?
Oh, mountain bikes. Pretty lucky from the get go being born in Colorado and, you know, having parents that would take me out and, you know, grew up like 30 minutes outside of Boulder up in the mountains. So most of the evening spent during the week was just digging jumps and messing around and playing outside. So I think just from a young age, just time spent outside was key. And a lot of my friends' parents just took us on all sorts of trips. And I think it was just that exposure to that kind of culture of just always being outside. And the bike was kind of the one thing that I truly loved from a young age,
right?
The bike and skiing. So, things just kind of progressed quicker with the bike than skiing. So that was kind of the path I took. And, there's like a few kind of like junior development programs in Boulder, SMBA, and just had some really strong mentors there from an early age. Like, my mom wasn't super into mountain biking originally. It's just expensive and dangerous. And
yep.
She took a little convincing to come around to it. But it was kind of like through those mentors and that community that I was able to get into it. And they brought me to a few races. And yeah, once I did a couple, I was pretty hooked.
Yeah, no doubt. So what year did you get going as far as your race career?
Racing, the first race was in Crested Butte.
Okay.
Mountain States Cup 2003. So Crested Butte's always been a special place to go back to and ride. And we've done a lot of film work and projects and trips and adventures up there. And riding's endless. So it's definitely my favorite spot in Colorado.
What role do you think the Mountain States Cup played in your life, your upbringing?
Another thing, just like so lucky to have a huge race series like right here in the backyard. I mean, it was like, you remember, I mean,
yeah,
it was a huge crew and everyone was like, you know, really fast and pushing each other. And that's what it takes, is that community to kind of drive you to even dream up goals of racing on the World Cup or at that level.
Right.
You kind of need to start with a solid community, and the Mountain States Cup was definitely that.
Was that for you? Yeah. It's amazing to me to see how many people have gone on to do really cool things.
Totally.
From,
yeah.
from that little
Crushing on the EWS this year, and all sorts of people back in the day. Just really, really solid crew.
Yeah, still involved with bikes, which is rad
for sure.
So let's chat through some of your adventures as you were coming through the ranks as a racer. You were really, really young, probably 13, 14 years old when you kind of broke on the scene and started like crushing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I got lucky through that program. Like, my mom and dad didn't really have like the money to buy me a bike, and this guy had an old Lens Sport, and he ended up just giving it to me.
Yeah.
He had it for a raffle for SMBA and like just decided to give it to me instead.
Wow.
And then that. Kind of pieced together a bunch of old parts from the old VW Trek team and like just made it happen. So that was kind of a cool start to just to, like, my first bike fully get hooked up on. But I don't know, just after doing one race, I just totally fell in love with it, and it was just like every race I could get to, I had to get to, and just really fell in love with the community aspect of it, as well as just trying to do as good as I could. But yeah, looking back on it, it's like kind of cool to have such a driven like idea of what I wanted to do from such a young age.
Yeah.
And even now, I mean, I'm not racing anymore, but I've transferred that same kind of energy and mindset and skill set to what I'm doing now. So
It
all kind of kicked off in those early days of racing.
Totally. What were some of your favorite sponsors through the year? I remember you had an Orange for a long time.
Yeah, I rode an Orange for a couple years. And then I think when I was 17, I rode for Specialized for a year. And then when I was 18, I rode for Yeti. And now it's been 10 years.
10 years with Yeti?
10 years with Yeti
this
year. So
yeah,
it's been a cool ride, and working with Yeti in a lot of different capacities. As an employee for a bit, and as a downhill racer, as an enduro racer, and now just contract film work and as an ambassador. And it's just cool to work with a local brand and just a bunch of great people over there.
When you started with Yeti, did you like know there was a rad connection there, that this was going to be a long-term kind of thing?
I mean, I've always liked to kind of work with sponsors more long-term. Works a lot better, but yeah, I mean, never thought about leaving Yeti once I started riding and working with them. Just when they're in your backyard and such a good group of people, there's no reason to go elsewhere.
Totally. Yeah. So after doing so well on the local scene, you took off for the World Cup. How was that?
I think looking back on it, I was probably a little young. Uh-huh. I think I was like 19, 20.
So just old enough to compete.
Old enough to compete in the World Cup. And I don't know if I was quite ready. We went over to Europe for like the full calendar, and it rained every race. I'd never ridden or raced in the mud on routes, and definitely got pretty worked.
Yeah.
But end of the season came around, and it was like the Wyndham home track, nice dusty race, and did pretty good at that. So, but I think I figured it out pretty quickly that didn't totally want to do World Cup downhill racing. Wasn't quite what I wanted to do, and got hurt the next year and kind of slowed down the pace of things a bit. So
did that injury make you shift your focus at all?
Well, and that was when enduro was coming around, and did a few races and just really enjoyed the format of riding more. And, you know, the downhills was just travel half rail the world for the 3-minute run. And
yeah,
just a lot to handle. And, you know, was really just in it for the love of riding and the community and the whole kind of culture behind it. So when enduro came around, it was just like game on. And I think it kind of suited my riding style a bit better as well. So yeah, I think going into, was it 2011, 12, 13, 14, those are kind of like the big years of my enduro racing after downhill.
Okay.
And I'd say that went a lot better.
Yeah.
But I definitely took a lot of what I learned on the downhill World Cup to the enduro.
Yeah. What do you seen? And what are some things you felt like you learned from World Cup experience?
Just keep going.
Yeah.
It's not always going to work out, but But I don't know. I mean, I felt like I was just so young when I was racing downhill. I didn't quite have like the wits about me to do it. I mean, I feel like even now I'd just be able to do way better. Just to keep an even keel and, you know, keep pushing on and figuring out what you need to do better. And yeah, it just all happened so quick. So
yeah, so fast.
So
yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of able to achieve a lot of my higher end racing goals through enduro, which was nice. And then the adventuring came about super quick from that.
Afterward, yeah.
Yeah.
So I remember you came back from the World Cups and I was checking out some lines on, we were racing Crested Butte and they had just built a new course, I think. And there was this rock garden. And I remember you coming through and you just jumped the whole damn thing. You just cleared the whole rock. And I was like, holy crap, like to come back from the World Cups, did you kind of see lines differently after that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that high level of racing, and even if you're not at that specific race performing at that level, you're still exposed to it. And you come back to your local race and you're gonna have a whole new mindset of what you're capable of.
Yeah.
And so I think I brought a lot of what I learned doing bad at the World Cups back home and was able to turn it into something pretty positive and just have some good local results.
Nice. Okay, so let's talk about collegiates.
That was
a fun time, man.
It was a great time. Yeah. You know, racing collegiate was some of the best times.
Yeah.
Just every fall, like every weekend we'd go out and race, and just, I don't know. That's where I met most of my best friends is, you know, in college. You know, you're kind of at a point in life where you're all, you know, I don't know, just down with doing the same things, and you get a good crew together and you just become best friends. So yeah, we just would go to the races every weekend and have a blast, and see you would always crush it.
Yeah.
Some good rivalries.
Yeah. Who were some of the biggest rivalries?
Oh,
the collegiate scene on the,
definitely Rocky Fort Lewis.
Mountains. Yeah.
Definitely Fort Lewis and CSU. Fort Lewis always took us at nationals, but wasn't for our lack of trying.
Who had the better costumes at the?
They had like coaches, and it was a whole nother level. We were just kind of ragtag bunch of buddies, but it was good times.
Stopwatch timing.
Stopwatch timing, like just gotta go fast enough that you know you win. Those stopwatch margins.
So you can speak Spanish pretty fluently, right?
I don't know. It's receded a bit in the years past, but yeah, go down to anywhere in Latin America and from there for a couple of weeks can pick it up pretty quickly.
Okay.
Definitely get around and communicate, but I wouldn't say I'm fluent.
Okay. So talking about getting around, tell me the story about getting to the venue for Pan Am Champs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Pan Am Champs were a really cool event back in the day. I don't know, went two or three times in Guatemala and Mexico and Colombia. But where were we? We were down in Honduras. Or no, the Guatemala one. Yeah, we're down in Guatemala. And what was it? We're in the truck and there was like the volcano going off and all these sinkholes were popping up in the city. And it was pretty much mayhem.
And you ended up, you hopped in like a back of a local's truck, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And hitched to the venue.
Was that sketchy at all going through?
I don't know. That was kind of like the start of the adventuring days for sure, though.
Okay.
Like being able to travel somewhere like that for racing was kind of eye-opening and seeing trails.
So you were teammates with Aaron Gwynn,
mm-hmm.
Jerry Graves. Some pretty big names.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Richie Rude,
yeah.
A lot of fast ones.
Yeah. How do you think that those guys influenced you?
Man, those guys are just all three of them. I mean, some of the three most accomplished riders, racers in all of mountain biking, for sure. And I don't know, just spent a lot of time with them and just kind of saw their focus and drive. And I mean, even today, I feel like in the filmmaking, it's like still like drawing that kind of like dedication that I saw they had, you know, and kind of apply that to what I'm doing. But yeah, I mean, following Richie, you're going to learn how to mess up some corners and go fast, and just following Aaron and his track speed. And
yeah,
yeah, pretty lucky to honestly to have been able to ride with him as much as I have.
What's it like to go that World Cup speed to try to chase Aaron down? Do things just kind of get blurry at a point?
It's been a little bit,
yeah.
But still ride with Richie a fair bit,
yeah.
And usually can keep up, but I would never like figure out how to go that fast on my own. But when you're following him, you can kind of just stick on that speed and
yeah,
and actually ride that speed. So, yeah, I think track speed it can keep up with those guys pretty well, but it's more just like the overall racing kind of fitness endurance package that those guys are. That's what makes them the best.
Yeah, they are truly. So do you still race?
No, it's probably been three years
uh-huh.
since the last race. And
do you miss it?
Not so much. I've just fully taken that energy has its outlet, and that outlet's filmmaking and going on these big adventures and, you know, whatever I want to do, I want to be fully committed to. So
yeah.
When I made the flip, it was like, I'm not going to just half-ass race. I'm either going to be on top of my game or not race and just put all that energy into what I'm doing now. And it's working. So,
yeah. So let's talk about that transition from racing world to the media side of things, not only in the mountain bike world, but in other industries as well.
Yeah.
Other sports as well. How was it for you? Was it pretty smooth?
I mean, I was always super interested in photo and film.
Okay.
You know, Yeti's always been kind of at the forefront of producing that stuff. They were actually the first company that did the race film reports, like the old video kind of podcast. Like
right.
Those were the first ones with Jared and Liav and Blinky back in the day. And so, yeah, I mean, they had a couple in-house employees that did photo video work, and, you know, I'd work with them as a rider, as an athlete, and just learn as much as I could from them. And they ended up being like super great mentors and kind of got me started on the path of taking photos and videos of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also the year that I raced World Cup 2010, World Cup downhill, that at the end of the year, my house was in a fire and I lost everything.
Your trails too,
right? Yeah. Every trail I'd ever built, every item I had ever owned, all burned up.
Wow.
And the University of Colorado gave me $10,000 in cash. And instead of buying random shit, I spent every last dollar on camera gear. And I was like, this is what I want to do.
Wow.
And I'd always thought about the longevity of racing and what I really wanted out of it. And it really came down to, I loved the community. I loved riding, and I needed that outlet of energy, but when I shifted it to filmmaking, it just kind of, it worked a lot better.
Yeah.
And adventuring as well. So yeah, I bought all the camera gear 2010 and kind of just made a few projects for myself, and kind of, that was the best way to kind of learn, was to kind of give myself an assignment and, you know, make a short little movie.
And go for it. So what were those first couple?
Well, we made a couple movies of road tripping in my buddy's school bus up north. And riding and kayaking and skiing. And so, yeah, those are the first kind of couple videos that I made. And one of them, the second one we made, ended up getting into a film festival. And I kind of saw this whole world. And at this film festival, I met all these, you know, renowned outdoor adventure filmmakers that, at the time, I had no idea who they were or what they did. Like, and now they're like, you know, not just idols, but peers.
Yeah. And mentors in some ways.
And mentors in some ways, for sure. And
yeah.
Oftentimes collaborators and working with them on various projects. And, but yeah, it all kind of happened really quickly. It was just this like really intense year where I didn't do well on the downhill World Cup and the house burned down. And I just made this like very drastic switch to, you know, wanting to be a photographer, filmmaker, adventurer.
Yeah.
And our first big adventure film was a couple years shortly thereafter. And a couple buddies and I just wanted to get into bikepacking. We'd never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
It was like before bikepacking was really, really, really a thing. I mean, obviously people have been doing it for decades. But
it was less mainstream.
But it wasn't really like a branded, like, this is what people do, this is kind of a category of biking. And yeah, kind of around that time, 2013, 2014, that's when it kind of kicked off. And yeah, we just bought 3 plane tickets down to Peru, convinced Chris Conroy from Yeti to give us some demo bikes, and we ended up making a film down in Peru.
Was that the one where you got held up by gunpoint?
Yeah, no, it's pretty dramatic. We got held up by gunpoint. I got a concussion. We're in these mountains at like 16,000 feet. Like, our buddy Sam had done a Knowles course that was like our only real like adventure knowledge.
Wow.
And we were out there for 12 days.
Yeah.
Well, we were down in Peru for almost a month, but definitely a wild eye-opening trip, and ended up making a film, and it totally blew up. And that was like, really, once you get momentum in something, then that's kind of, you know.
Yeah, you kind of see that potential. And
totally. It's like racing. You know, you win a race, you want to do more races.
Right.
So, yeah, it was kind of that feeling. And just from then, it was always just like, what's the next big adventure? What's the next big project? Like, let's do this.
Are you constantly planning?
Like, and I honestly, since then, it's just been full send every day, all day, doing something to kind of go further in that direction.
Yeah.
And the great thing about filmmaking is there is a... in adventuring is there's just a lot more longevity to it, you know. You can still do these hardcore trips and make films about mountain biking and ride bikes a lot, but long run, I mean, the sky's the limit for filmmaking, you know. Whether it's working on more commercial work or full on features or what have you. It's just every day is so exciting knowing that, you know, half my work's mountain biking, but the other half is totally open and can be anything.
What other areas are you working in?
We worked on a fly fishing film in Bhutan.
Okay.
With the king of Bhutan.
What?
We got a shot a Coors Light commercial last week.
Really? Wow.
So yeah, no, I mean every week is just is pretty wild, pretty interesting, pretty entertaining. And okay. Yeah, I'd say mountain biking is like obviously where my heart's at and where a lot of my projects are surrounding. But definitely want to make sure I'm carving out enough space to kind of grow outside of just mountain biking too.
Yeah. Do you feel limited by mountain bike industry, or do you feel like?
I mean, I really enjoy working with all the partners that I work with in the mountain biking industry.
Right.
I've been working with them for a long time, so it's just smooth. But no, I mean, I don't want to be known as only a mountain biking filmmaker is kind of the main thing.
Gotcha.
Like, I mean, when I'm 50, I probably do a couple mountain biking things here and there, but I'd love to be working on like features, to be honest.
Wow. Cool. Hey man, it's a great, phenomenal goal. You'll get there on your current path and say you're going in a good direction. Okay. So let's go back to the bus. What was the bus? How did you guys come by this?
The bus was, the mastermind of my college roommate and lifelong best friend, Mason Lacey. We were roommates in freshman year of college in the dorms at CU, and one night we're doing homework, sitting next to each other, and he was cruising Craigslist. It was like right when Craigslist kind of came about, and he saw this school bus for $3,000 in Boise, Idaho, and he was like, "Dude, we need this.
We're going for
$3,000." And so, drove up there, drove it back down, and we had a school bus, and it totally changed the way we do trips.
Yeah.
Whether it's bike trips or raft trips or ski trips, all of a sudden we had, you know, a full-size school bus with couches front to back that you can fit all your friends in, all your gear in, no worries, and you're cruising down the highway at 70 miles an hour, hanging out in a living room, essentially, with all your best friends. So, yeah, we ended up, that was kind of the premise of the first film, was a road trip with 10 of us, 9 of us up to BC.
Mm-hmm.
And
is the bus still around?
Oh yeah. The bus is still kicking.
Still kicking?
Yeah. It's been to Canada twice. It's been to Mexico. It's been to the Grand Canyon. It's been all over.
Yeah.
And it pays for itself. You know, I mean, it was $3,000. He had to take all the seats out of it, put the seats on Craigslist just for the hell of it. Sold them for $1,000 for someone who's looking for school bus seats. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Thing runs like a dream.
That's amazing. I remember you had a hot tub? Like
portable
hot tub?
Yeah, no, yeah. Mason is the mastermind of many a good, bad idea. We had the portable hot tub in the back of the bus for a little while. And never a dull moment with friends like that.
Okay, so you mentioned that you're on like a contract basis with Yeti. So you're not a full-time employee there.
Yeah. It's like right after college, I went on for like, I think almost 2 years as an employee. And like when I was in college, that was kind of like when Facebook and Instagram for brands was kind of coming about. So I started all of Yeti's accounts and basically just created a job for myself. And I enjoyed doing that, but I really wanted to do more of the photo video side of things. So it was while I was an employee at Yeti that I was, you know, living at home with my parents, saving as much money as I could, and basically investing every dime I made back into kind of creating a camera business empire, if you will. Yeah, ended up with a couple Reds and like the full kit, and then started getting some kind of more client work outside of Yeti, and that's when, you know, Conroy is the owner of Yeti, has always been, you know, a really good mentor of mine, even in racing, and he's always offered advice, and he was just like, we'll always hire you, but you're going to become a better filmmaker if you're working on other projects as well. And so we were just like, kind of came to this mutual agreement that I'd be better off kind of working for Yeti freelance. And it's been a couple of years now and it's been absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
But Yeti is absolutely, Yeti's definitely like the main client for sure. I'd say that's at least half the work. And always a pleasure working with the Yeti crew, just knowing them so well and being on the same page.
Yeah. You know, Yeti was, in my mind, one of the first brands to really kind of take their time with some of the media that they're putting out and really craft what's going on and perfect it and make it just gorgeous.
And I think a lot of the reason is because, A, they've always had, you know, some talented people in-house, but the fact that they were hiring in-house just naturally affords people a bit more time on a project. I feel like when you're freelance, there's a tendency that you can get a little rushed to get onto the next job, to the next job. But when you're on a salary and working at a company, you just naturally have a little more time to work with projects and let them breathe. And so I think in that sense, like having, you know, at least half the creative in-house has really worked out well for them.
Do you ever, I wouldn't say rush a project. Well, yeah. Do you ever rush a project to get some things live?
There's always your A projects and your B projects.
Right.
But I mean, a project like this Nepal film I just made about Rajesh Magar, Nepal's fastest mountain biker, that's like something you just can't rush. Like even if you need another job to make more money or whatever, it's like there's certain projects. If you want to be a real filmmaker, you have to take the time and give it your all.
Do it right, yeah.
But then, like, you know, a lot of commercial work is just more people, a couple days, boom, boom, boom.
Interesting. So, do you feel like the media landscape is changing at all? I mean, we kind of live in a world where everybody's just on Instagram and flipping through, and to have kind of the more long-form stuff like you do.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, I just do what I want. I mean, yeah, sure, people want quick, this, that, and
yeah.
I definitely, you know, do the Insta stories and post up on the gram, but I want to make longer form, you know, storytelling pieces. And I think it's hard to put an axe in that ever.
Right.
I
mean,
people are always going to enjoy longer form films. And people don't have the time, I don't care.
Yeah.
If you don't want to watch it and spend 20 minutes, that's fine.
Yeah.
But that's what I want to make. So, yeah.
Yeah. Just get immersed
in it. The mentality you have is, yes, some people are going to start watching this film and realize it's 20 minutes and probably not finish it.
Right.
Fine.
So to do these crazy adventures and to film at a quality that you guys do, what type of gear requirements? I mean, it's got to be pretty insane to carry all of that with you on
for sure.
Multi-day backcountry.
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of the whole gamut. Like, obviously, in a commercial shoot, you got the Reds and all the red bricks you need and all the lenses you need, whatever, tripods, Ronins, what have you. And then when it comes to adventuring, it's just how far are you going to scale back? What style of trip are you going to do? it's just like kind of all these different factors. So every trip has been different. It's kind of like almost feels like doing kind of a custom build of the trip. You know, you figure out how many days you're going to be out there, how much food you need, where you can resupply, what the weather is going to be like. You kind of go through all those factors first, and then how fast you want to move. I mean, some trips we've tried to go too far, too fast. And when you're trying to make a film at the same time, you definitely have to afford some time for that.
Oh yeah, big time.
So I think we kind of, we've just been tuning it in project after project. But yeah, I mean, for some of the bigger adventures, like in China and in this Tibetan Autonomous Region last August, just about a year ago, we were out there like 10 days and it was super rainy, absolutely nowhere to restock food. And so, you know, you have a pretty pared down kit for a trip like that.
Right.
But the technology has also been growing phenomenally fast. So we were even able to carry like a teeny little drone on that trip. Whereas mm-hmm. 5 years ago, that was just, no one even had drones.
Yeah.
So it's been pretty wild to kind of see that shift.
Yeah. That whole transition. What kind of like time and complication does it add to things? Is it twice as long to do that type style of trip, or does it really depend on the project?
I think originally it was like twice as long.
Yeah.
But I think we've kind of gotten to the point now where it's like you just kind of plan the trip as if you were not filming it and then dial it back a little from there.
Mm-hmm.
But done a lot of the projects with kind of the same, relatively same kind of crew of people, and our buddy Sam is like, he was the one that did the Knowles course that kind of got us like,
got you guys through,
kind of got the brainchild going for these kind of adventures. He's always the one that's like, he understands when the light's good, we're gonna lose some time.
Okay.
But he's also the one that like kind of keeps things in perspective and keeps the reality of the adventure alive once I get totally FOMOSing on the camera. So
keeping each other,
I think we've kind of grown in filmmaking together and can kind of find that balance together now.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was Sam's best adventure idea and his worst adventure idea?
Sam is usually a part of all the good ideas and somehow avoids the bad ones. I think our worst adventure idea was for this film we made called 55 Hours in Mexico.
Okay.
Where we flew to Mexico essentially for a long weekend, 3 day weekend. Not even. I mean, we left midday Friday and we're back Sunday night and climbed and skied the third tallest peak in North America. It's like 18,500 something feet.
Uh-huh.
And it's this volcano in Mexico, believe it or not, Pico de Orizaba. Straight off the plane to Veracruz.
Okay.
Bags don't show up, so we're already delayed. Get the skis. Like hauling skis through a coastal Mexican town. They're like, what is going on? Get a shitty rental car and just fight it up the mountain to like 13,000 feet. And then from there,
and then just start
hike to the top, ski down.
Yeah.
Straight back to the airport home.
So what inspired that one?
I don't know. Just I think there was some like some boulder folklore that someone had done it before and we went for it. But felt absolutely wretched going from sea level to 18,000 feet in a matter of hours.
Wow. Yeah. Might even be some like health concerns there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Was able to capture my buddy Carl throwing up on the summit, looking down into this insane crater way above the clouds.
Yeah.
And just bombed on out of there. It's pretty wild to be skiing in Mexico.
Yeah. How many of your adventures are kind of spur of the moment? Like, game on, let's do this thing.
There's a lot of spur of the moment, smaller adventures at home.
Right.
Like leave at midnight and go bike 50 miles and climb Long's Peak and bike back home.
Yeah.
Random things like that.
Just a quick 50 mile ride.
Yeah. But the big ones, they just take planning.
Right.
And time.
Yeah.
For sure.
A lot of forethought, no doubt. When you want a project like or an end result like what you guys create, you have to do that.
But obviously, there's an unfathomable amount of unexpected things that happen along the way, and that's what makes it an adventure.
Yeah, so those unexpected things, like getting held up at gunpoint, or, I mean, it seems like every one of your films has a handful of unexpected things, and that's truly what makes it part of the adventure.
Oh, yeah.
But what are some of the wilder ones that you've been a part of?
Last summer in China, we're, 10 days bikepacking around these three massive 22,000 foot peaks. We're kind of at like 16, 17,000 feet the whole way. And to get out of the mountains, we drop down this valley gorge to get back down to the small little town where we started after the full loop. And we dropped down a different valley gorge than we had come up. Looked like there was a sweet trail. We dropped like 9,000 feet and it basically just started getting steeper walls on each side, narrower, tighter, and there's a river flowing through it. And we kept crossing all these bridges back and forth to get to the trail on the other side. And as we made our way down, it was just getting, the river was getting gnarlier, the walls were getting steeper, it was raining, and we dropped like 9,000 feet, and there we were, and one of the bridges was washed out, and it was like pretty much like mega class 5 water, like ripping through this valley, cliffs on either side, and
what'd you do?
Back up we went.
Back up to 9. Wow.
Ended up being like a 20 hour day to finish that one out, since it was the end. We were dropping down to presumably the town where we started, and there was no food left, so it was just do or die. Crossing the river was not an option.
Right. Yeah, class 5 sounds gnarly.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to deal with what you dealt.
Yeah.
But it's all in the...
How often do you find yourselves in situations like that?
Something like that is bound to happen. And if it's not, you're probably going to just end up getting sandbagged by a bunch of Russians drinking vodka. That's probably the sketchiest.
On the trail? Or what?
We did this 10-day bike packing, pack rafting trip in Mongolia.
Okay.
And we, again, finished all our food. We're completely out last day. And our driver came to pick us up, but he comes with a slew of Russian fishermen on a bachelor party trip, because he was like double guiding and brought them in as he was picking us up. And we asked him if we could have some food, and these Russians like fed us this elaborate meal in the backcountry of these fish they'd caught and like all this like fresh fruit, which we hadn't seen in weeks. And we were just so excited to have this huge meal. And it ended up like, after dinner, he slams a bottle of vodka on the table. He's like, you eat with us, you drink with us. This is how it is. And needless to say, the 6-hour bumpy ride back the next day was not so smooth.
A lot bumpier, yeah.
The fermented mare's milk stop along the way was not super desired, but just got to roll with it.
Do you think it's possible to adventure too far, too hard, too...
I don't know.
Yeah.
We've got this buddy, Ben Page, who helped me with the RJ Ripper film.
Mm-hmm.
He just spent the better part of 4 years bikepacking around the world, rode the length of 5 continents, and he doesn't seem burnt out. So, I mean, there's always people out there that are doing much gnarlier, harder stuff than you are. It's always important to remember that, but... I don't know. It's definitely important to find that balance of going on these amazing adventures and beautiful places and just taking the time at home to kind of chill and recharge and live a bit of a normal life.
Yeah. Does your mind ever stop racing as far as what you want to be up to next?
No. I mean, I think just the nature of working for yourself and this industry is like you always have to be thinking a couple steps ahead. But... Not too dissimilar from racing, and the fact that you're always kind of planning your future, plotting your next moves, and
So you mentioned meeting a kind of another world within the film festivals, and I think it was within that period when you started doing some things with the Camp 4 Collective guys. really interesting crew of filmmakers. The Moab video, though. Let's talk about it. So, was that the one that Nier jumps the canyon in, or was that a different video?
No, that was just a photo shoot.
Oh. But did you guys actually send, like, what happened to that bike?
So, yeah, Anson Fogel, one of the directors at Camp 4, just, you know, enjoys mountain biking, had never worked on a mountain biking project before, and just raised some funds to make this kind of spur-of-the-moment idea that he had for a bike base jump kind of short film to kind of hit the film festival circuit. And, yeah, he got a crew of base jumpers and mountain bikers together. And, went out to Moab and kind of filmed a whole riding scene. And then it kind of culminates in this insane bike base jump where they rip up to the edge of a 400-foot cliff on a brand new SB6 and
send it. Yeah.
Fully attached to the bike, pulling the chutes, bike swinging between the legs.
Yeah.
Like clipped in, full deal, and like, you know, theoretically landing and riding away, kind of. But definitely a wild, wild experience to be a part of.
Yeah.
Never really seen the base jumping world, and
yeah.
Not gonna get into it anytime soon.
Okay, and then Nier jumping over the canyon, you say that was a photo shoot.
Yeah.
You peer pressured him into that?
Kind of. Yeah, I mean, Sean Nier and I grew up racing together, so there's always been this little back and forth. And we had the opportunity, once he signed with Yeti, to go out and shoot some photos in Green River. And had a full week of shooting and digging and riding, and things were going great. And he'd lined up this canyon gap kind of the first day and said if he was feeling good, he'd do it on the last day. And, of course, you know, had to get the light right. So we were up there at 6 a.m. and...
Oh. 6 a.m. sending.
6 a.m. It's cold. First line of the day. And it was pretty gnarly. I would not hit that thing for sure.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know, good ways across, but a long ways down.
A long way down.
And, yeah. He hit it once and the light was okay. I was like, whatever. And then the light just started firing and I just like give him this look and he's just like, no, I'm not doing it again. But he pushed up and did it. And yeah, ended up being a 2-page spread in outside, I think.
Nice.
So yeah, that's always been another kind of big goal of mine within mountain biking is to kind of expose mountain biking more outside of just the normal realms.
Okay.
Bringing it to these adventure film festivals, mountain film, Banff, kind of trying to get it in these outdoor magazines that aren't necessarily bike magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the work I've done with Nat Geo Adventure, just trying to kind of be a voice for what mountain biking is and adventure mountain biking kind of outside of the core media realms in mountain biking. Just, yeah, I don't know. I just enjoy kind of bringing it to that different audience.
Yeah. What are some people or some organizations, film crews that inspire you that you think are crushing it right now?
I've been pretty lucky to work with the Felt Soul Media guys. They funny enough, they do a bunch of the Yeti Coolers pieces.
Okay.
They've done a bunch of films for them and a bunch of Patagonia films. So I'm kind of like the third or fourth string for them. If they get a big enough project and budget together, I'm usually working with those guys.
Nice.
But that's what's cool about the whole kind of scene is that, you know, it's not just these set companies of people working together. Everyone's friends and
Right. You'll
bring so-and-so on for this project and so-and-so on for this project. And everyone knows each other's work and what your best strong suits are. So yeah, the Felt Soul Media guys are great to work with. Camp 4 is always crushing it.
Yeah.
Really look up to Renan and what he's done. Renan Osterk, he's a professional climber and then got into filmmaking. So I've always kind of look to him to kind of find that balance of, you know, how are you still a professional climber and doing filmmaking? And, and you know, he did that film Meru and it's kind of that self-documented adventure style. So it's just kind of finding people that are doing it better than you are and figuring out how you can do it too.
Yeah.
it's just like racing. But yeah, Feltzel Media, Camp 4, Tallweg is another production company I've done some work with. So yeah, there's some great people out there.
Yeah,
doing some amazing work
in the mountain bike world. Do you think is doing some awesome stuff?
Man, there's so many awesome, you know, filmmakers out there in mountain biking these days. John Reynolds, who taught me a lot of what I know, is working with Clay Porter, Metis Creative. They're always crushing it.
Yeah, big time.
Liam Mulaney, some of those guys up in Canada are amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff like that, like seeing mountain biking kind of grow outside of just the mountain biking world is refreshing and cool and important to grow our sport. Yeah.
So outside of mountain biking, you're also a big time, you really enjoy skiing, mm-hmm. like ski mountaineering.
Yeah.
How did you get into skiing?
I grew up skiing. I was doing it when I first started biking.
Okay.
Just kind of it's more accessible than mountain biking. Growing up, it was a cheaper thing to do. So my parents had always done it and just kind of was a no-brainer. But with how expensive mountain bikes are these days, it's pretty hard. Or initial barrier to kind of get into the sport, I think. Whereas skiing didn't quite have that, at least back then. Kind of took a back seat for a while when biking was the only thing and racing was, you have to be very one track minded. If you want to be a good racer, you have to be pretty dedicated and focused. So kind of stopped skiing. And then when I started adventuring again and kind of figured out what ski touring was, you don't have to just go to the resorts. And
right. How was that transition for you?
It was really cool. Actually, Brian Buell, another guy that we grew up racing with in the Mountain States Cup, was the first one to kind of get me into ski touring.
Okay. Like your first backcountry adventure was with
Yeah,
him.
Yeah. Yeah. With Brian. But it just kind of blew my mind that you can kind of analyze the terrain and work your way through some big mountains, and kind of just fell in love with it. Just kind of harkens back just to growing up in the mountains and loving being in the mountains, and skiing such a pure way to do that when you're touring out there. You're not confined to just a single track or a trail. You're just kind of roaming.
Yeah, you have
which is pretty
huge
cool.
Huge canvas, no doubt.
So, yeah. And I also realized that, you know, when I was racing, I would just moan a lot about the snow and the weather. And
right.
Just, you know, you can't ride. We're dealing with all this weather. It's terrible.
So you picked up some skis. Yeah.
So, you know, if you just don't complain and pick up a pair of skis, there's always something you can be doing, whether it's pack rafting or skiing or climbing or biking.
Yeah.
I mean, in Colorado, you can do one of those things every day of the year and have great conditions for it too.
So I was told that you had a sponsored extreme sledding team also.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was my first actual sponsor. I had an early on little mini filmmaking career in the extreme sledding realm. We started a film company when we were like, I think 8 or 9, called okay. Complete Insanity Films, and did a series of sledding films for a couple years. And one of these films actually ended up in like 2010. I think it had a couple million views on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Just of sledding, basically fail compilation. And this sled company sent us 10 sleds, like $1,000 sleds. And immediately when they showed up, my mom thought I had just hijacked her credit card and ordered sleds for the whole crew. But lo and behold, we landed that sled sponsorship.
Yeah.
And that was the first real sponsorship. And that was, I guess, at a 10-year-old age, kind of eye-opening, especially at that time before there was any social media or anything, realizing that you can create something for a brand and
get something back
from it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. Do you find, is it comfortable living, doing what you do in the manner that you do it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely been enjoying it. I mean, I've been with my girlfriend for 4 years and she lives a bit more of a normal life. So I think it's good to have that kind of balance to kind of come back to. But yeah, I mean, I think for now it's pretty sustainable, but, I think long-term you want to do bigger projects, bigger budget, just kind of move a little slower. I mean, that's kind of the end goal, I think.
And polish things even more.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I think working for yourself, even if you're doing really well, you're always in the back of your mind thinking, what's next? Where am I going to, you know, how am I going to make this work?
Right.
Even if it's working just fine, you're always kind of thinking about that a little bit. But don't have to be at an office at 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. every day.
That's right.
Kind of just roll out of bed and live your life and do what you want to do.
Yeah.
So it's the ultimate freedom, but a lot of work.
Yeah, no doubt. Do you find that the brands that you work with ever kind of try to control the way things are conveyed or
the For sure.
end product?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just different styles of projects. Like some of them, you're kind of pitching your vision, your idea, and it's your passion project. It's what you want to create. You're the true director. And sometimes they come to you and tell you what they want and you make it. So, yeah, it's a mix for sure.
And, even on the adventure side?
No.
Okay.
I mean, all the adventure projects, true adventure projects that I've done have just kind of been projects that I've pitched out and kind of brought to life. So, but yeah, I mean, obviously for the commercial work, they've got a concept and you act on it.
Okay. So in all your traveling around the world, what are some of your favorite places to visit on a mountain bike that people might not think?
I think the coolest place, my favorite place, has been the Republic of Georgia.
Where's that?
It's such an interesting place because it's basically, it's between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, north of Turkey, south of Russia. It's at the crossroads of the Middle East, Asia, and Europe, and there's such a strong influence from all of those. It's a third the size of Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own language and alphabet, and it's just a very, very, very interesting place. It was an old Soviet state, and now they're on their own.
Yeah.
A third of the country is occupied by Russia, and they avidly hate Russians. But really good people. Like, it's like kind of like traveling to Europe, like pretty easy to get there. Really good food, really, really, really nice people, beautiful, beautiful country. The Caucasus Mountains span from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea, and there's unbelievable amounts of these old villages all connected with prime single track. And I have heard there is a trail that you can connect that someone's kind of like put together an organization to kind of mark it out and maintain it from one sea to the other.
Wow.
The full mountain range. So
yeah,
I mean, there's endless riding there, and you're not going to have to worry about any sort of trail user issues at all. You won't see anyone else out there. You'll see some Polish trekkers. That's probably it.
Right.
But, yeah, I think that's the coolest place. That's my favorite place I've been is the Caucasus Mountains of Georgia.
Interesting. Yeah. It's definitely, that's one I've never even heard of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we also went with Bryce Minnig, who's now the editor at large of Bike Mag.
Right.
But, he was a correspondent over there in the Chechen Wars. So he speaks Russian, and going on a trip with someone that can speak the language kind of gives you a whole nother perspective of the people you meet and the region, and him having that previous experience there was just pretty wild to hear about.
And what's the most horrible thing you've ever had to eat just to keep going?
Jeez. Probably the Mongolian fermented mare's milk.
Okay. Yeah, that one
it's hard to watch. Horse milk, kombucha, little boozy.
Uh-huh.
Not too boozy, but they just store it in a fur bag on the wall and just ladle it out. And you cannot refuse it.
Right.
You cannot. And it's not as bad as you would think, but it's just the concept. You know, you walk outside in the morning and you see the old lady milking a horse, and you're just like, but I don't know. You just roll with whatever the locals do, and you'll probably be fine.
Yeah, yeah. How was it holding that massive bird?
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting to hang out with the eagle hunter was a special experience.
No doubt.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so what's next for Joey?
Going on a bike packing trip in Europe, hut to hut, without carrying too much gear, photo only, not trying to beat myself up too much.
Okay.
Got another big kind of story-driven mountain biking film project in the works for next year, hopefully. Still kind of forming some ideas around that, and Grand Canyon rafting trip. It's a rough life.
Yeah.
But yeah, always an adventure.
No doubt.
Always on to the next one.
Cool. Well, we are in Snowmass, Colorado. We're at the Yeti Tribe Gathering. What's the Tribe Gathering for people that haven't been to one?
The Tribe Gathering is a wild collection of Yeti freaks. I mean, it's crazy, but you know, the brand has such a culture and a following behind it that people come from all over the world, and some really, really interesting people from all sorts of different walks of life and all over the world are here this weekend to ride and have a good time. Yeah, we did a big ride yesterday, good party last night, and we're going back out to ride right after this. And 450 people up here all riding sweet turquoise steeds.
Turquoise steeds, yeah.
But it's cool to get together and kind of meet like-minded people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what do you say we go, Jonah? Let's get some laps in.
Let's go get some laps in.
All right, buddy.
I'll take the chairlift today.
Your legs feel it?
Thanks, man.
Yeah, cheers, man. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Vital MTB's The Inside Line podcast. Episodes drop every other Wednesday. Thanks to Jensen USA and Maxxis Tires for the support. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Vital MTB.